Hey, welcome into All Ball. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this week's guest is, I think you're really, Aaron Gannat is the head coach at Hawaii. He had a really fascinating life before becoming the head coach at UH Manoa, and we're going to talk about it from being growing up in Jersey as the son, twin son of immigrants, going to Swarthmore, playing for a legendary coach, and then shunning what you would think would be a six-figure job on Wall Street in finance to go and be a volunteer assistant at St. Mary's and live in a like a two-bedroom house, which he had a car repoed, and ultimately becomes the head coach of UH Manoa. Like, that's a really interesting tale. Plus, some of the things he's learned along the way, a coach or two that he admires. I think you'll enjoy our conversation. We have got a chance to see a little bit of the NBA. And, of course, I'm fascinated by the Lakers and what LeBron looks like. And I told people when he signed there, look at their roster and look at how he played in the NBA Finals. And he was guarding Draymond Green. You're going to want to try and find a mismatch for LeBron James as he creeps into his mid-30s. Wouldn't surprise me at all if he plays a good amount of center. They play small ball. And the one mistake that people make about the Lakers is they take last year and they say, that's what Josh Hart is, that's what Brandon Ingram is, that's what Lonzo Ball is. Young, older players, they get to be role players. They are what they are until they lose a step and they're out of the league. But younger players, especially with the player development that they have with the Lakers, they're going to improve. And so on paper, it looks like this is not a good enough shooting team. Rondo, Lance Stephenson, JaVale, they bring toughness and experience, and a couple have championship pedigree, but they don't bring shooting, and you need shooting around LeBron James. Well, a couple things. One, I think LeBron will make them a better shooter because if he's playing four, he's playing five. He's just a tremendous passer, and his ball dominance, people gravitating towards him, creates open shots. Secondly, they're going to improve because the longer you're in the league, the better a shooter you become. But while everyone's paying attention to the Lakers, I'm fascinated by the Celtics. I don't know. Maybe it's because he's wide or he played in Utah. We seem to have forgotten how good Gordon Hayward was as an all-star in the West before became the biggest free agent on the market 2 years ago. But Kyrie didn't get a chance for a full training camp with the Celtics last year. He does this year. And he wasn't fully healthy last year. He is this year. You had two all-stars, and in Kyrie, a guy who's a top 10 player, to a team that went to the Eastern Conference Finals. Game 7? Make a shot, they probably win. I think people are underselling just how close the Celtics are in proximity to the Warriors, who won't be complete until they add DeMarcus Cousins. And let's be honest, when they add DeMarcus Cousins, if he's going to play in the fourth quarter, they're not playing small ball. They can't switch everything. Changes who they are. We'll also cover a little bit the scandal in college basketball and the testimony which we're seeing in this federal grand jury testimony. But without further ado, let's get to our conversation this week on All Ball with Aaron Gannat. All right, the All Ball podcast continues on. I wanted to not only preview his basketball program, but he's got a fascinating kind of life story and life journey that's led him to being the fourth year, is that right? Fourth year head coach at Hawaii? Man, it does seem like yesterday where we were in the second round of the NCAA tournament in Spokane, Washington, hanging out, getting ready as they had upset. It was supposedly an upset against Cal, but it was a beatdown against Cal before they lost in the second round. He's Aaron Gannat. He joins us here on the All Ball podcast. Aaron, how are you?
I'm doing great. Another perfect day in paradise. Can't complain.
Yeah. What is it really like? I mean, for a guy from the States, and you grew up in Jersey, went to college in the East Coast, before heading out to the West Coast and working for Randy Bennett, what is it like every day to wake up in Honolulu?
I don't want to sound too cliche, but it is living the dream. I mean, you're doing what you love, where you love, with people you love, nothing better. You know, I was so loyal and still am to Jersey. It's a little different. I love Jersey, but Hawaii's pretty nice.
Now there are challenges with Hawaii basketball, right? Like, there's some budgetary issues with the entire athletic department, but also there's this sense that, hey, we can get everybody to visit. Anyone who doesn't want to visit Hawaii, what's the actual, like, can you bring anybody in? What's the limitations on how many kids you can actually bring to campus?
Well, as you know, we can only get 12 visits. I think you get 24 now. A couple of years ago, they changed. You can have 24 official visits over a two-year period, so you can vary it, whereas before it was only 12 per year. But, yeah, I don't know if it's that difficult to bring certain guys on visits. Like you said, there are some challenges here, but I think we put all our time and energy into the great things we have going on because we do have a lot to sell, a program that's got a lot of momentum, a state that's unbelievable with great people. So I think it's an exciting time right now to be here.
Let's go back to your childhood, because it's not like that. It's not like mine, right? Like you didn't grow up in a basketball household. You have a twin brother, and your dad immigrated to the United States from Romania. Your mom immigrated from Israel. What was it like? Where was it? Tenafly? Is that where you grew up?
Yeah, small town. So we actually, my brother and I were born in Philly. And then went to Bergenfield, New Jersey, and then basically moved to Tenafly in 87. So kind of grew up there. I went to elementary school, middle school, high school, and then after graduating in 99, went over to Swarthmore College, which is only about 2 hours away in terms of a drive. So spent our years, formative years, growing up in Jersey. I have an older sister, a younger sister, a really low-key family. It was a low-key city, a great city where people kind of knew each other, and about 20 minutes from New York City. But I was very much an East Coast guy and basically felt like East Coast was Hawaii at the time.
Swarthmore is a great, not good. Like I'm not underselling it when I say it's one of the premier private liberal arts schools in the country, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was very clear when, I had been recruited there and kind of with the background I had that was where I was going to go, especially when I didn't have as much say and my parents knew about how good the school was and that's where you're going. But I really appreciated there. Met a lot of lifelong friends, great professors, played for a really good coach, a guy who's a mentor to me, someone I talk to often still. But I really appreciate my time at Swarthmore.
Who's that? Who'd you play for at Swarthmore?
I played for Lee Wimberly, who's retired as the winningest head coach there. He was there for about 25 years, actually coached at Bellarmine Prep in the late 70s, early 80s, and then was assistant coach to Greg Popovich for 2 years at Pomona Pitzer.
That's amazing. So what was he like as a coach?
He was good. He was, well-balanced as a coach. I learned a lot from him about, just cared about the guys, on the court, off the court. An academic, he went to shoot. He was a graduate from Stanford, got his doctorate in jurisprudence from Cal Berkeley, and did take a sabbatical for a couple of years to be the head scout for the Spurs before he came back to Swarthmore to finish out his coaching career. So just really valued how much he cared about myself and all the guys.
What did he run? How did you guys play?
He was big on scouting, so we kind of mixed things up in terms of, we played a lot of man, a lot of zone. There was an offense. He actually took a lot more sets. He took a lot. We even ran an offense called Egan, after Hank Egan, who was with him when they were working together for Pop in San Antonio. So a little bit more of a structured system. The game has obviously changed. That was almost 20 years ago. But in terms of the international, the free-flowing, and so back then it was more of a set-to-set-to-set structured and mix it up a little bit on D.
All right, so how good a player were you?
I started off pretty well and got hurt. Didn't really play much my last couple of years, but pretty solid Division III player. Wasn't good enough to play Division I or anything.
Point guard?
No, how it is. In D3, we had four or five guys go abroad like mid-year, so you might start at the two, and by the second semester, you might be playing some four. And I'm only 6'2", as you know. So, but that was kind of the life of Division III basketball, and especially at a liberal arts school. And we only had 1,400 kids, but it was awesome. I prayed for very much the love of the game. I thought our league was really good. My brother actually played at Franklin Marshall for Glenn Robinson, who's close to 1,000 wins right now. And, programs like Johns Hopkins and Haverford and, just really good league with a lot of good programs.
Wait, so you actually played against your twin brother in college?
Oh, yeah, all 4 years. Don't ask me how we did against them.
How'd you do?
No, they were a powerhouse. What's great is Swarthmore now has become been to the tournament each of the last 2 years, I believe, under Landry Kosmowski, who's, if you remember, was an assistant at Davidson, who's done a really good job there. And just to see a lot of those programs do well has been nice to follow from afar.
Okay, so you get done in 2003, and you graduate. And so what was your plan, what, to go to Wall Street?
Well, even when I went to Swarthmore, I knew it was a good school, and if there was some 1% chance that I love the game, I love being part of a team, I love to compete, and a lot of it was the academic school that Swarthmore was, but I saw Coach Wimberly's background, and I thought there was a good chance that I would want to continue to stay in the game. He knew a lot of guys, and it ended up working out for me, but my background, if the 1% chance that I didn't go into and stay involved in basketball, that would be set up. I had an economics background, and most of my opportunities were investment banking. But, as you know, and we've talked about before, I was really excited to get a volunteer opportunity for Randy Bennett at St. Mary's.
Okay, so, but take me through kind of the timeline. I mean, this is the great thing about what I want to do with this podcast is people like you, your path to becoming a head coach, and you won the Red Auerbach Jewish College Coach of the Year Award a couple years ago. I think it's just kind of fascinating. So you graduate, like, literally, you walk in graduation. Did you come home and try and figure out what you wanted to do? Were you getting ready to go work in finance? Did you right away pack and go work for Randy? How did it actually work?
Oh, so that stretch was pretty clear. You go through the anxiety a little bit of, hey, I might have some opportunities, and I did in terms of investment banking, but this might not be what I want to do. It was clear that it wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to be involved in the game, and so how does a Division III guy get an opportunity to get his foot in the door? I mean, it started with, I emailed, which email was a lot bigger than we didn't have some of the things in terms of communicating with coaches. I emailed and wrote a letter to all 350 Division I coaches, and I was blown away by the responses I got. Some guys with advice, and it wasn't, hey, can I, it was more, well, how would you advise someone like me who wants to, start this path? And a lot of guys recommended, getting working camps and, just getting in front of people. The two things that stood out to me was Phil Martelli invited me to his office, and they were about St. Joe's, about 20 minutes from Swarthmore. And so I went up and met with him. And Lawrence Frank was the other one who I met up with him at his office. He went to Teaneck, which wasn't far from Tenafly, where I grew up, 5 minutes, and met with him in the office. And he was the third assistant with the Nets at the time, and as you know, all the time, when you look back, you keep in touch with people, and Clippers were actually here, this week doing training camp, so it's fun, and I see Coach Martelli, and so that's how it started. Just worked, I worked Kentucky camp, I worked Virginia, I worked St. Joe's, I worked Villanova with Jay Wright, and I talked to him about that, so it's just, that's how it started, and eventually, it led me to Randy Bennett hired me the phone through my college coach. My college new coach knew Coach Bennett, and he hired me over the phone in August when things were looking bleak as a volunteer. And then I just kind of grabbed my stuff, a little I had, and went over there, and he picked me up from the airport, and here we go.
Wait, what would your parents say when you said, hey, I have this great degree. Your parents are two successful, educated immigrants who made a life for you and your family, and you said, hey, I'm going to go work for free in Moraga, California for a private Jesuit school?
Yeah, I think there was some disappointment there. There was a lot of concern. There was maybe we want to sit down and rethink this, but I think they knew me pretty well to know that, hey, even if we talk about this, this is clearly what he wants to do, and he's going to chase it. And so I think they finally change their tune, maybe 10 or 11 years later.
Okay, so you get out. Randy's there. Who else is on the staff when you get there?
Great staff, great players. I mean, it's funny to look back. When I was sharing an office with Lamont Smith, who was obviously recently the head coach of San Diego, is now at UTEP. Across from us was Kyle Smith, who's been the head coach at Columbia, now at San Francisco. And this is 2003, so what? This is my 16th year coming up. Randy's obviously still there. Dan Schell, who was one of our assistants, who's done a great job working with Fox and IMG since that time. And just Todd Golden was one of our players, who's associate head coach at USF now. So over the years, the amount of – there's some guys who have emerged and running their own programs right now and doing a great job with it.
Didn't you have your car repoed when you were there?
No, actually, I didn't have a car. I mean, there was a stretch. My parents actually moved to Brazil because of my dad's work. They had a lease on this car for about a month. They sent it over, and, I'm stuck paying paying this last month. I didn't really want it because I didn't have the money to pay for it. So it's funny looking back on it, but I was glad when that got out of our system.
Okay, and then wasn't there a stretch though where you were at Hawaii as the director of ops? When was that?
So I worked for 3 years as a volunteer at St. Mary's, trying to, you know, soak up a lot of knowledge. It was very much an apprenticeship, learning from those guys. But obviously, you know, you're volunteering. I was able to make some extra money through camp, build a good relationship with the people at the cafeteria that helped me out, maybe felt bad for me. And then, but you know, life was simple then. I didn't need much. I was just happy. You know, I was trying to figure out how I could stay for a fourth year at one point when clearly I didn't have the funds to do it. But through that relationship, it's funny because Randy Bennett hired me over the phone, and then after year three there, you know, I get on with Riley Wallace, and he hires me over the phone, and then I flew over there again with not much stuff. He picked me up from the airport, and so I spent 4 years there, and this is my second stint coaching, my third stint coming back to St. Mary's for 5 years, and then coming back, obviously, in 15 as the head coach. It's crazy
when
path.
It's a crazy path, and you inherited a program that, for people who don't remember, in your first year, the NCAA said that you're going to be on probation the year after your first year, and then all the players were free to kind of transfer, which many of them did, but you took that first team that had some talent to the NCAA tournament. You beat Cal, which was a loaded team in the first round of the NCAA tournament. There's a lot of young basketball coaches. Heck, I'm interested in it because I've interviewed for a couple of jobs. The interview process at Hawaii, you had been there before, but there's years in between, right? There was like 8 years in between. No, not 8 years. There was, I'm going to say like five years in between, right? When you left there as an assistant coach and when you interviewed to be the head coach. So you knew some people, you knew the area very well. You knew a lot of the different important people. How'd you get the job in the interview?
You know, at the end of the day, it's very competitive, as you know. And so, you know, I felt, you know, I had prepared, you know, the whole learning from the ground up, working for Riley Walsh, working for Randy Bennett, working with the people I work with, I just felt at the end of the day I had been ready for this position. I just had done every aspect. And I worked for guys who really empowered you, gave you a lot of responsibility. And then you combine that with my knowledge of, you know, Hawaii, what they were going through, kind of my background in helping programs go through that. And I didn't think anybody had as much passion as I did for not just the job but the state. Especially with what they were going through. Like, I wanted that challenge, and I think it could have scared some people away maybe because there were some dark clouds that no one knew what would end up happening. Of course, it wasn't very good when we found out the clarity of what was going to happen, but it kind of gravitated me more towards that. You know, I always said to people that, you know, the dream job should be somewhere, in my opinion, where you kind of played or coached. And so I had a lot of, you know, my heart was into it, the affinity to be there. But you know, I've been preparing it since day one, so it was kind of working the interview deal and speaking from the heart and being very clear on what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. And you know, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity, and I'm very grateful for that.
Your first day as head coach, everybody, you know, anybody who's ever played and thinks about coaching has in their mind how they think they want to be, how they think they want to talk to the team, the type of staff they want to put together. Well, in your mind, how did you approach it?
Well, there's an old line, like, number one, have a plan. Number two, be flexible. And it basically became, once I got there, and be very flexible. I had known a little bit about what's going on. You have to imagine this is a program at that time that was going through a perfect storm in a really rough way. There's NCAA clouds looming. There's off-court issues. There's academic issues. And here I come into that, and you only know so much from afar. So I probably spent the first stretch really getting understanding what exactly was going on, and then it became scratch that plan and readjust, and it just reconfirmed what you always believe in, and in the foundation and the culture. The best thing I did, I think, was I spent the first, with all the pressure on recruiting, and you know, let's put it this way, people, and I was like this, when they get an opportunity like that, you're thinking build, build, build. And it became clear that we needed to stabilize first, which we've done, and I'm really proud of, before we can build. If we skipped steps, we would have been in the same situation over and over again. So the first couple of days were spent with, in terms of relationships, meeting people and flying to homes. And guys were all over the country because we had a lot of international players to meet with these kids and their families and get to know them. And a lot, it was really tough, but it was the best thing I think we did.
One of the things that I learned about your style was you started early morning workouts with the players, and for a couple of weeks you guys ran them, but then didn't you turn it over to the players?
Yep, I think that's part of you're building your program and your people talk about X's and O's and development, and our big part of our program is development. Period, not just player development, academic development, personal development. Developing future leaders. I think we all know sometimes people want to get this Mr. Coach thing going, which we all like to do, but you're not going to be as good as you can be. Your ceiling is not as high as you can be if your players aren't empowered. Now, they have to earn that, but that group did. And it was amazing to watch a group that's been through so much, that has so much potential individual talent, come together and created more investment on their end, and then they ran with it. And as a coach, there's nothing better to sit back, relax, and watch them go and get out of their way when they hit that point. It's a special moment.
Yeah, but then you completely had to rebuild the program, though, because they were all gone after the first year, weren't they?
Yeah, no. So there's usually, as you know, when we go through something, we know what we know, or we study from others or people that have gone through something. So not many, I think you said this earlier, have gone through the issues or the penalties the following year. It's usually that year. So while it was great that our team came together to, go on a historic run for our program, I was just as proud of the last two years, basically, because they actually had to deal with the reality of the situation. And, you build this deal and then you lose. We literally returned one total point per game from that team you covered in the NCAA tournament. So, again, it became a great opportunity, a great challenge. We talked a lot about what we have, not what we don't, what we can do, not what we can't. And that group's done a really good job to set us up for this year, where we're back up rock solid in every area, have 8 out of 10 back, had a 2 guys sitting out, have 2 ESPN tournaments we'll be part of. I just can't say enough about that group because I know, like you said, a lot of people talk about that NCAA group.
How do you – like, look, you're in paradise, and anybody who's ever been to Oahu, it's a thriving nightclub scene. There's the beach. There's all these tourists that come by. And I know that they call, what do they call, Las Vegas the what island? Is it like the 6th island
the
or 7th
island?
The 9th island. Sorry, I forgot how many islands. It's the 9th island, right? But there is a little bit of Vegas to Oahu, especially to Honolulu, right, in that there's a lot of things that can divert your players' attention. How do you do that? Because, like, in the real world of basketball, a lot of these guys, they all think they're going to the NBA, whatever, but they also want to have a good time. How do you get your players to focus?
Oh, perspective is important. I think, number one, we have a committed group of people on our staff and our players that we either develop within or that we bring in. We identify guys who can understand the balance. Now, I'm big on balance, and something I've had to learn as a coach. Just still working through, sometimes coaches can get out of whack there. But I am a big believer you're not going to be very good if you're not happy. You're not going to be happy if you're not, and you need it all aligned. You need to do what you love. You need to be with, in a great situation and be with people that you love to be around. So I think we found a good group there. You also have to find the correct balance between fighting like heck to get better, but also enjoying the journey. So how do you balance that with a lot of great distractions we have here? Well, we just make sure we're in balance. We're not out of whack. We talk a lot about perspective, how hard it is to be good, the sacrifices you need to make. But understand there is a balance there. I do want them to enjoy the great things we have here in Hawaii, and we have a lot. But it's a constant reminder of the sacrifice we need to have to be good. And once they kind of buy into that and see that, it's reinforced. And like with the culture now, it comes from the staff, and now the seniors show the younger guys, and we're always on the same page. And when we have those moments, we veer off, we identify right there and keep going.
Give me a sense of why Randy's been able to be successful. I look at what Randy's done, taking over program, won 2 games to now, you know, consistently banging heads with Gonzaga, who's really a high major in a low to mid-major kind of league. And you know, they've redone McKeon, but it's not anything spectacular, right? It's tucked away there, you know, 20 minutes from Cal Berkeley, you know, one of the best, you know, public school in the country. What's it really like? What's the secret sauce really to what he's able to do?
I don't know if there is really a secret deal, and I'm sure he would say this too. I mean, you know, someone asked me about him last year, and you know, to talk about him, and you know, I just think you could argue he is, or maybe, you know, he's one of the best coaches in the country. Could argue he's the best in terms of perspective, things you just talked about, what's been done there, his discipline in terms of the routine to stick with it, in terms of his program and the fundamentals over and over again. There's not much fluff. You talked about the bells and whistles, but they have the right bells and whistles, and good programs do in terms of, you know, they got guys who are committed to each other. They work, they're united, and he does an outstanding job of that. So I think there's so many people looking for some magic formula, and he found it, but it's not something magical. It's just the daily discipline to stay locked in over and over again for so long, and they're not going away.
Give me your best Randy Bennett story. Somebody says, give me a Randy Bennett story. What is it?
I don't know. I got to be careful. I mean, for someone who's so dedicated, sometimes he can be an absent-minded professor. I've had those moments too. I think sometimes I've had my car run out of gas in the middle of the road, and he'll give me crap for that, and then he'll have it done to him the next day. So he can be so locked in on what's going on and forget some of those other deals. But, you know, I think it's hard to find so much on him because he's, like I said, remarkably consistent.
What about Riley? Riley is an absolute legend, and I played against his teams, but it was when it started. It was 99. What was that? 98, 99. They were talented, but not like they were when AC was there, when Anthony Carter was there, and they had that incredible backcourt. But still, Stan Sheriff Center was a tough place to play. But he was just, I mean, he's such a legend that he's still like an ambassador, I think, to the state, right? And isn't he like a? I mean, he's a really kind of interesting guy. They used to run that flex, which I'm not a big flex guy. Give me a Riley Wallace story that for somebody who never worked with him, didn't hang around him, kind of embodies who he is.
Well, first, Wallace is larger than life. He's, like you said, he is a legend. I'm very much sitting in his office. He's the coach of Hawaii. He's the face of the program. We inducted him in the Circle of Honor a couple of years ago. And, you know, he's a, you know, a tough guy, but, you know, a heart of gold, and he will do anything for his guys. And I learned so much from him in terms of, you know, how much he, you know, there's some coaches who just think about their programs. And like you said, in terms of the ambassador, he was everything Hawaii. He was at every team's games. He was at every team's fundraisers. He was, you know, meeting with the state and fighting. He fought for the arena. I mean, I learned just so much from him and how caring he was. But, you know, he was the most direct coach I've been around, which I always loved. He was very much in your face, whether you're a player or coach, told you exactly where you stood. And then he would do things for you with you not knowing, like, hey, to support you, to encourage you, to push you. And if you thanked him, he would always say, I didn't do that. But he totally did that. He was just trying to continue to play off this tough guy exterior. But, you know, we visit him every year. You know, he's had some health issues, as you know, and he's such a fighter, but he taught me when I was there as a director of operations. I didn't know anybody. He picked me up from the airport. I had lunch with him. Remember, I'm not making much. He took me to lunch every single day from Monday through Friday that I was there for that 1 year with him because he had retired after that year. And I was a guy who didn't really try many foods, but he would say, hey, we're having halibut. I don't want to eat halibut. He'll eat this. You're fired. Okay, I'll eat this. And one day he made me eat pig's feet, and you know, and he said, I'm not eating pig's feet, or I think it was chicken feet, and I'm not eating that. We'll eat that, you're fired. Okay, I'll eat that. You know, so he and I talked to him every couple times a week and this was 06, since 06. He's as good a mentor as you could have.
Your favorite Hawaiian food is what?
My favorite Hawaiian food. I am a big beef stew guy.
Where's the best place to get beef stew in Honolulu, in Oahu?
Well, if I'm fortunate enough to be invited, Wailai Country Club got the best.
Very nice. You have to be invited. You don't get automatic membership.
No, that was only Coach Wallace. I'm not there yet. That's still, that's like yeah. I said, he's, yeah. he's the
gotta
man.
Go back,
I'm not there.
Back to the, that's part of the renegotiation, back to the NCAA tournament. The place you grew up playing basketball in Jersey was what?
The Tenafly courts, which are still there, the outdoor courts.
Do kids, I feel like that nobody plays outside anymore.
No. I mean, that was back, you know, when people, you know, you forget, when you're East Coast, you get the seasons. I forget it now, but with the winter, we would shovel snow so we could play. And that was a big deal at the Tenafly courts. And then you go there now, and there are not many people there. And you're thinking mid, you know, early mid-90s, it was hard to get on the court. And obviously you got to win to stay on, and you have to adjust to the wind and all that, but it was great. And it's a shame that it's, like you said, what's happening with, you know, playing outside.
The most difficult place you've ever played or coached is where?
Most difficult place, probably at Gonzaga. You know, I think I remember when we beat them for the first time, Mickey McConnell had a step through over Robert Sacre, and I can't tell you how great that locker room was firing.
Oh, I mean, unbelievable. And then Mickey McConnell, like, think about that deal. He was set to play for New Mexico, right? And Richie gets fired, and so he, you know, he gets out of his letter and comes and plays for you guys and has an incredible career. You know, if not for Richie getting fired, like, none of that happens. I mean, just, it's really remarkable how those things take place.
No, it happens a lot, and you hear that with a lot of programs, and, you know, just these little breaks and guys who come in, because Mickey, you know, played behind Patty Mills for 2 years, and Patty leaves. It's, you know, how do you replace Patty? And then here comes a guy who, first year playing a lot, is an all-conference player, and the second year is player of the year. So that's the great part of doing what we do. There's a lot of great stories.
Okay, so the last part is, give me the update on your family. For people who don't know, your sister-in-law tragically died in a car accident, and you and your, I think she was then your fiance, right? You adopted
right.
your daughter. And remember, this is for people who are, like, trying to catch up. This is back in, I'm going to say, 2012, right? So you're...
That's right.
You're at St. Mary's as an assistant. I think the car accident was in Oregon.
Yeah, Chelsea, Barbie's sister Chelsea, was in a car accident in September 2012. She didn't do anything wrong, obviously. She was pushed into the other lane and going the wrong way, and by someone who had some road rage, and, you know, she passed away. And I remember getting the call from Barbie's father. We were about to walk into a meeting at St. Mary's, and hearing the news, and obviously making sure it was relayed to me so that I could be there when we relayed to Barbie. There are no positive sides to this story. The only thing was that the 18-month-old Ziza was not in the car, and obviously, as you know, we've raised her since. She's, to think about how much time's passed, she's 7 and a half now. She'll be 8 in March.
It's really, really amazing. I know the anniversary just came and went. What's that all like to go through when you're, you know, obviously not only you became a parent, but you're also helping your spouse mourn, and then you're also coaching, one, recruiting, second, all these meetings. Like, how do you process all of those different kind of emotional aspects of your life while maintaining what you're doing in your profession?
Well, I think that's where you lean towards continuing to lead. It's, you go through it, and that experience, you know, moving forward, you know, there's so many things that are awesome about life and things that are give you a lot of heartache and are really tough. And and being in a leadership position, you got to continue to stay composed and be supportive of those, and make sure you're someone they can look to for stability and support. And, you know, I can't imagine, or obviously no one can imagine, hearing news like that and the amount of emotion it goes in. But you got to be able to compartmentalize. You got to be able to sometimes just be there. And, you know, because it was a very difficult moment for a lot of people. You know, I remember being with her for a couple days, you know, in Walnut Creek, and then driving over to Myrtle Creek, Oregon, spending, you know, a week there, going through all that, and then shifting gears. But it's something, you know, that comes up every now and often, you know, on the anniversary. And, you know, Barbie has been, and her family have been so special through it. And obviously, and you got to meet Ziza. She's an awesome young lady, and a pleasure and a treasure to have around.
Yeah, I know. She's really, really, she's amazing. Of course, I know your players love her. Tell me about this team. You mentioned 8 of 10. I know Sharif's back. I know Bugs is back as well. This is a pretty talented bunch. You guys got off to a good start. I remember the one-point loss to UC Irvine, the Big West tournament. What's your biggest challenge heading into the season?
Well, you know, you lose two good players in Mike Thomas and Gibson Johnson. And Mike Thomas, you remember, was their starting format on the NCAA tournament team. But but that's part of being in a program. You lose some guys to graduation and other guys emerge. So I feel great about where we're at, where we're headed. You talk about 8 out of your 10 coming back. You have two guys in Mate Kalina from Melbourne, Australia, who played for the COE, and Justin Hemsley from Damien High School in Southern California, who sat out. Then you add, you know, three recruits to the mix. So I think clearly, and hopefully some of this will emerge, our balance might be the best since we've had it. We might not have a guy who's emerged as the superstar yet. Now, I think even the team you saw, guys played into that. You know, even you're talking about Mickey McConnell, guys emerged. Sometimes you think you got to bring in, but you can develop it too. And so I think if anything of the challenges, it's a good challenge, is while we bring a lot back, what's great about our league is there's probably about six teams that bring 7 or 8 out of their top 10 back as well. So it makes for an exciting league slate.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously the travel is dynamic for you guys, but you're going to spend a lot of time in Southern California in the wooden, what is it called? The wooden, what's that?
Legacy.
Wooden Legacy. And then, of course, you got to play Fullerton and Irvine and Riverside and so on. Of course, the David Patrick, who's now at Riverside, who's a former another former Randy Bennett guy. Like, you guys are all kind of getting together, and you'll tell better stories there than you told me. Like, you wouldn't even sell him out. You wouldn't give me anything. I just need one Randy Bennett story. I'm not asking for all that much.
And we'll take that off the air for those. We got some good ones on each other. It's just funny, you know, you look at DP with Riverside and Rick Croy, you know, right now with
Cal Baptist
and Adam Capehorn, who's now over running the Center of Excellence in Australia. And they're guys in the mix that will be future head coaches, guys on their staff now that are terrific. Marty Clark, who's now back in Australia, worked with the NBA Global Academy. It's a group that's real close and supports each other. And is, you know, you spend so much time together for so long, and then you're scattered. That's the good and tough thing about it.
Yeah, and then the only time you're together right now is when you – well, sometimes when you're recruiting, but also when you're coaching against each other, to which there's not really time for pleasantries. Last thing, the coach who has no idea, but you have an incredible amount of respect for, that you have thrown on their tape and learned something from watching, or you watch their game and you're like, man, I think that guy is really, really good, and he has no idea I think he's really good.
Well, he wouldn't know. I have an idea. Brad Stevens is the guy I kind of watch a lot. The one that I respect the most that I haven't worked with is Greg Popovich. I've been fortunate because of, like, the connection I told you with my college coach, that to spend probably a training camp with them, you know, probably 3 or 4 times in the last 6 or so years. So he's probably the one in terms of how you run Pop in terms of how he runs his program and how he deals with his players and the stuff he runs. But recently, Brad Stevens a lot. Those are the two guys.
You know what's funny is Brad and Randy, I both saw their teams practice. I think they both, maybe Randy's team lost in the finals, but I did the Diamond Head 3 years in a row, and they were in different years. And both were two of the 5 best practices I've ever seen run, and both had an incredible amount of detail. Both teams were remarkably, like, the kids walk in, they all have great looking haircuts, and they look like you'd want to, and they're the toughest damn kids that you could find. And both practices emphasized fundamentals in an expert way in which you'd see it come out. Like, my brother's big on passing and catching, and I work with kids now in passing and catching. And there was all of that in practice, and it was one of those deals where it was before Brad's teams had made a run in the NCAA tournament. But I could tell you then that, like, they were going to do it. He was the real deal. And in watching Randy, I would tell anybody, listen, like, this is 2 of the 5 best practices I've ever seen in my life. And it wasn't anything necessarily special. It wasn't any drills. It was just the quick attention to detail. You could see how the teams were tough when they played. And the fundamental aspects of catching, passing, pivoting, and spacing, that I think everybody's kind of trying to teach. They understood how to teach on a practice-by-practice basis, and you could watch. You watch one practice in Stan Sheriff Center the day before the tournament began, and you knew their teams had it.
No, and those are the goods. You try to tell that to your team because there's a tediousness to it. There's, you know, but the repetition, it could be considered to some boring, but those are the goods. I mean, you can run a lot of great plays and a guy can't shoot, and a lot of great plays and a guy can't pass. I mean, you bring that up, it's funny because the first time I went to the Spurs training camp, I was sitting with Coach Wimberly, and they're literally doing pivots and jump stops and snapping passes with two hands and thumbs down, and he's telling me this is a lot of the stuff he's done when he was at Pomona Pitzer, and it's just great to see those guys rewarded for the way they're going about it, and so that's the things I look up to.
It's funny. I started coaching. I was watching I moved to California. I put my son in a little – there's AAU program workout, and they're doing Euro steps, and they're taking shots they can't make. And they got done, and the guy came over, "What'd you think?" And I said, did I come in late? And he's like, "No, you're here early." And I said, "Well, where is the part with the catching and the passing and the jump stops and the pivoting?" And he goes, "Well, you think we should do that?" I was like, "Yeah, that's the part you do every day." I said, "Yeah." And so now it's funny you mentioned boring. Like, my son's 9, and he's like, "Dad, do we have to do the pivoting and the passing and the thumbs up and thumbs down?" I was like, "Yep." Yep. Yes, you do. The other stuff is just it's amazing, and it is the challenge, especially with a kid ADD, to get him to do it every day. Ron, I know you got to run. You've been so thoughtful with your time. I wish you nothing but success, and of course, safe travels every time you guys get on a plane, and love and respect to your family. We'll see you when you come to the contiguous 48. In the meantime, enjoy paradise and best of luck this season.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it as always, and look forward to seeing you soon.